We're really happy to have you here for our event titled Energy Efficiency, How Cheap, How Easy. Today's event is part of a larger series we're doing called the Solution Series, where we focus on technologies, fuels, policies, strategies, and the opportunities and challenges associated with them and how they can become part of an eventual energy solution or solution to our energy and climate challenges. We're really happy to have such a distinguished group of experts here with us today. This is an event long time coming. We've wanted to do an energy efficiency event for quite a while. Energy efficiency is often regarded as sort of the cheapest, easiest, most readily available source of new energy supply and emissions savings. But if it's so cheap and it's so easy and it's so readily available, why aren't more efficiency gains actually realized? And how can we make sure that in this new administration, sort of 2 weeks out from an election, a few months out from a new administration, a new Congress, that these energy efficiency gains are actually increasingly realized and policymakers and companies make the investments necessary to make us a more energy efficient society. So in order to help answer that question and talk us through some of those issues, we've got a panel, a distinguished panel of four experts led by our main speaker today, who's Joe Loper. Joe is the Vice President for Policy and Research for the Alliance to Save Energy. Next to him, we have got Larry Makovich from the Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Larry's a senior advisor and vice president. He also directs CERA's research efforts in the Global Power Group. Next to him, we've got Karen Palmer. Karen comes to us from the Resources for the Future, right down the street. She's the director of RFF's Electricity and Environment Program. And finally, we've got Skip Leitner from the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. He's the Economic Analysis Director. We're really happy to have all of them here today. And the way this is going to work is Joe's going to start us off by giving us a longer presentation, sort of setting the scene about the opportunities and challenges associated with energy efficiency. And then each of our three other panelists are going to provide some commentary on some of the points that Joe brought up. So without further ado, Joe.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Frank, in the back of the room, for inviting me. I think you've organized this panel wrong in the sense that I should be responding because they're the experts. However, I will try to frame the discussion and set it up in a way that they will have plenty of things to criticize. I suspect that the reason I've been invited to do this is because of my involvement in the National Petroleum Council study, where Frank and Sarah both learned that I have many opinions. And so they were sure to get some opinions and provocations from me today, and which would give plenty of people plenty to respond to. Let me put on my glasses so I can see here. Let me tell you just a little bit about where I come from. I work for the Alliance. I'm Senior Vice President for the Alliance to Save Energy. We're a nonprofit organization that's been around since 1977. We're headquartered in Washington, D.C. Probably the biggest thing that we work on is policy advocacy over the years, sometimes less policy advocacy, sometimes more, depending on how much interest there is in Washington. Of late, there's been quite a bit, but we also do consumer awareness campaigns. We provide a number of different types of programs for technical assistance, that sort of thing. In general, I would call us an environmental organization. That's why I came to Washington to work on energy efficiency. But for an environmental organization, we have a very diverse set of backers, funders, and board. Our board is currently chaired by Senator Mark Pryor from Arkansas and Jim Rogers, who is the CEO of Duke Energy. We have a lot of associates who give us funding. To be clear, we're not a trade association, but we do get general purpose support from a number of corporations, environmental organizations, governments, and others, and they range from American Gas Association, Edison Electric Institute, Johnson Controls, the North American Insulation Manufacturers Association, and on. They, in addition to providing general support, often make us have to think through stuff. And I frankly, from my perspective, that's the most valuable contribution they make. Don't get me wrong, I like to have a salary and all, but to the extent that they make us smarter and force us to think through issues, I'm appreciative. The energy efficiency business benefits, probably everyone here is here because they understand the benefits of energy efficiency and its potential. If you're concerned about climate or national security or energy security or high energy prices or a host of other environmental issues that are related to energy consumption and production, then you should be looking at people should be looking at energy efficiency. It is often the cheapest, cleanest, easiest way to achieve those goals. The cost of the measures can be low. There's no nuclear waste associated with energy efficiency. There's certainly less CO2 associated with energy efficiency, and there's no battleships required. When I came to Washington in 1991, energy efficiency was certainly on some people's lips, but it was not dinner time conversation. Now it is. I mean, my daughter comes home talking about it, and I have to tell her not to talk about it because I'm tired of talking about it. I've been talking all day about it. Secretary Bodman has come out making very strong statement. If you recall at the beginning of the administration, there was some skepticism about energy efficiency and conservation. At least Secretary Bodman and others in the administration have come out saying that it's a very strong resource that we need to get. As I mentioned, the National Petroleum Council, they had the first sets of recommendations in the National Petroleum Council report were related to energy efficiency. Jim Rogers, our chair, says that it's the fifth fuel. Tom Kuhn, the president of Edison Electric Institute, has one-upped him, four-upped him maybe, and now is saying energy efficiency is the first fuel. And I'll one-up them both by saying that it's America's greatest energy resource. And Sarah mentioned that, you know, it's we're challenged wondering why more energy efficiency is not in the system, but I want to be very clear today that a lot of energy efficiency is in the system. In fact, since 1973, so over the last 35 years, energy efficiency and conservation measures as a result of those activities, we're now consuming 50 quadrillion BTUs less energy than we would have been. And that's adjusting for structural change and other things. And this is conservative. In fact, there are people on this panel who would say that the energy efficiency contribution is even greater than that. So that 50 quads, but just to put it in perspective, is half of total current U.S. energy use and exceeds all the other resources together. And that's why, I mean, exceeds all the other resources, at least individually, and that's why we call it America's greatest energy resource. There's huge potential out there. McKinsey study, and probably most of, how many people have not seen this curve yet? I've adapted it some with the green and stuff, but has anybody not seen this curve? Or this picture? Okay. So this is McKinsey is a consulting group, and they put together basically what is a supply curve for carbon abatement. And so from the left are the lowest cost measures, according to McKinsey, working up to the right, which are the high cost measures. The measures in green are energy efficiency measures, and then you have a lot of other types of things. So wind power, carbon capture and sequestration is on here, nuclear power, a number of other things. A couple things about this, and McKinsey was pointing to the negative costs on here, the energy efficiency, of which a lot of it is energy efficiency on the left side, and I will come to that issue in a few minutes. But I think it's important to point out that while some people have been critical of this, I haven't heard anyone say that the efficiency options aren't the cheapest ones. They may say they're not negative cost, and they may say that the order is different. In fact, some people in the energy efficiency community say, why are those energy efficiency things over on that side? They should be over there from their experience. But the ordering is probably less controversial than some other criticisms. There's a lot of potential out there, but we're going to need all we can get. And I don't want to bog down in graphs or anything, but this is basically a chart that compares different climate policy legislation that's come up over the last, 10 years or so, or actually less, 5 or 6 years. The red line is business as usual CO2 emissions. The bottom lines there are basically in accordance with what the IPCC says should probably be done to avoid cataclysmic climate change, or this would be the U.S. contribution, to be clear. The bottom lines there are about 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. That is a huge undertaking. And the McKinsey, I've interjected on here, the McKinsey mid-range reductions and McKinsey high range, but the chart I showed you before was their mid-range reductions. If you did everything that's on that chart that I showed you before, you basically get, in 2030, you're about halfway to where you need to be on a trajectory to get to the 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. So we got a lot of work ahead of us, even if you do all that cost-effective stuff that you think may be available now. Just for the record, or just to be clear, some of those things in the McKinsey curve, for instance, carbon capture and sequestration, has not been proven on at scale to be economical, and there's a lot of issues that have to be dealt with for that to happen. But there's a reason. There's reasonable prospects that carbon capture and sequestration will give you something. MIT says at $30 a ton of CO2 that CCS will start entering the system. So the energy efficiency, can you tell me like when I'm halfway done? The energy efficiency potential is uncertain. I think that's going to be a theme of some of the discussion. So the McKinsey, I'm not standing up here saying the McKinsey analysis is the analysis to pay attention to. Some of the uncertainties date back to when I was in, and long before I was in college, 25 years ago. Discount rates. People still can't decide whether you should be using the government cost of funds or the implicit discount rate of consumers or something in between. Economic growth is a major variable in determining what the baseline energy consumption is going to be, how fast capital is going to turn over, and whether people have money to make the investment. And so economic growth is a big factor. Energy prices. Energy prices, let's see, in last January, Lee Raymond, former head of ExxonMobil, was saying oil prices should be at $70 a barrel, that was the right price. At the time, they were at 100 and headed up. Goldman Sachs at the time said it'll be 150. Sure enough, it went to 150, but now it's back down to closer to 70. And so it's just a very difficult thing to project, but it has a huge impact on the potential estimates. Technology development, another big one. I'll show you a study done by EPRI that's not out yet, but will be soon, and that's it. But it does not. It basically assumes that what's out there is what you got. And it makes no. And EIA, the Electric Information Administration, in its projections in the annual energy outlook, that sort of thing, also assumes basically that the it doesn't assume any technology breakthroughs or anything like that. I'm very sympathetic to not assuming technology breakthroughs because I have no idea what technology breakthroughs are going to occur. But I do know that there will be some. And so assuming zero is problematic as well, and I think that's a theme I think that that Skip hits on a lot. A couple of very big factors in these potential studies is what you assume about market barriers in the market, so non-price market barriers, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about that in just a minute, but also policies. A lot of this is about how much policy you're willing to accept or that you think people are willing to accept. This is EPRI, Electric Power Research Institute study that should be coming out soon. These numbers will change. I've been talking to them, so these are not final numbers. But I show it to you to just show you the different types of potential for energy efficiency. You got technical potential, which is basically anything that's currently available technologically feasible. Economic potential, which does calculations on cost effectiveness. Maximum achievable, in this case, this is for the electric industry, is basically assuming that if the electric utilities will pay 100% of incremental cost, what you could achieve. The realistic achievable savings is what is more likely to occur by EPRI's assessment. And again, many people will people are disagreeing with this analysis in both directions. Okay, so one of the I said in these cost effectiveness or the potential studies is what you assume about market barriers. And ultimately, in the policy world, which is the world I live in, this is what we're all about. How do we overcome market barriers? The biggest market barrier, in my opinion, probably many, is externality cost. The cost to society of CO2 emissions is not incorporated in the price of CO2. And likewise, there's other things that, you know, not to pick on, I'm going to pick on CO2 throughout this thing, but there's also, you know, risks of nuclear waste, and a lot of other things. Acid rain, which has probably largely been incorporated because of, Clean Air Act regulations, but, you know, a number of other, national security represents an externality cost. There are split incentives. I rent my house. Fortunately, I got out of the housing market and am renting now, and I don't buy the appliances, but I do pay the energy bill. And so I can't make those investment decisions. I'm not deciding whether it's time to buy a new furnace or whether I should have an Energy Star dishwasher or not. My landlord decides that, and he doesn't pay the energy bill. So presumably, you know, at least arguably, he doesn't care. I'll come back to that in a minute. Energy subsidies. According to EIA, and this is for 2007, I believe, it's $16 billion going to different energy resources, one of which is energy efficiency, but most of it going to nuclear, coal, and the others. And I just throw this up to say this is actually when I first came to Washington what I worked on, is how you're going to get all these subsidies out of the system because they're not creating a level playing field for efficiency. And so this is a market barrier, a market failure, in fact. The number four is lack of information. For an efficient market, just the fundamental principles of economics 101 says you need perfect information. Well, we all know that that's not true, or that we all know that there's no such thing as perfect information, but certainly there are relative lacks of information. And with energy efficiency, there's often a lack of awareness about the opportunities that exist, and then what to do about them once you know that they exist. And then finally, there's bounded rationality, that people don't always make that's another fundamental concept of economic efficiency, is that consumers are rational. And I know I'm not in my daily life, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that people often aren't. And so I could give examples on the side, but I got to race through here. And there's other barriers that are cited, which I don't put in the numbered barriers because I'm a little more skeptical where they go and how important. I would target those other things, but there's lock-in. An example of that is with compact fluorescent lamps, where you had the bulbs were too big and couldn't fit into into your table lamp. Right now, that's no longer the case, but a few years ago it was, and so that would be an example of lock-in. I would call another one is big cars, and that is, you know, if you're going to go out and buy a small car, you may be concerned that there's all those big cars out there, and so to the extent that big cars are out in the marketplace, there may be, to some degree, some lock-in. Job number one with market barriers, again, coming back to my first one, which is externality cost, is get the prices right. And I know we're never going to get them right. It's always going to be an approximation, but we can get them more right. And right now, we don't get them. We basically implicitly assume that the carbon price, carbon externality cost, is zero, right? Except to the extent we're doing some programs and stuff. But for the most part, it's assumed to be zero. And we all know that ain't right. And we know that's far more wrong than probably anything that I've heard anybody propose in terms of a carbon price. In terms of carbon pricing, you can do a cap and trade, or you could do a tax. A cap and trade dominates the discussion in large part because it's more politically viable. And I can discuss that with why later, but let me just say, and I'll give. I think that Karen's going to talk some more about these issues, but I want to be clear: with a cap and trade, that the cap reduces emissions beyond business as usual. Trading reduces the overall cost of compliance. Okay. The elements to watch in a cap and trade are the cap. So is the cap strong enough? Is it reducing emissions enough to get on some sort of the target that you think is the right one? Is the scope expansive enough? Is it including all types of emissions, or is it leaving out large sectors of the economy? And then cost containment. Cost containment is a huge issue with respect to with energy efficiency. And with the stringency of the cap itself. Safety valves, for example, that would cap the price of carbon at, say, $14 or $7, various proposals are out there, would basically reduce the stringency of the cap. So you could have a cap saying it's going to go to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050, but if you impose that that safety valve, basically you're very likely not going to get there. Offsets also. If you have offsets in the economy that aren't real, especially, I can't get too much in detail with my time, but there's certain kinds of offsets. If you go do bad projects, if you go outside the scope of the cap and trade and go pay other people to reduce their emissions and count them as emissions reductions within your own cap and trade system, that is effectively reducing the stringency. And also cost containment, there's higher cost possibilities out there. And one is the allowance allocation can be a factor here. To the extent that allowances are given to electric utilities, for example, who are regulated and cannot, because the regulators won't let them, and the regulators force them to pass those free allowances on basically to the ratepayers, then the signal from the carbon price here is muted to the end-use customer. And so that's something that we're always watchful for. Energy efficiency is just one of many abatement options in a cap and trade. Everyone knows that. But if excluded, forcing energy efficiency can reduce the overall cost of compliance. If energy efficiency is cheaper and there are market barriers that are keeping energy efficiency out of the system, then the overall cost of abatement will be higher than if the energy efficiency is included. That is the case if energy efficiency is cheaper than the next best option that would be selected. And it's and it doesn't need to be negative cost necessarily. It just, again, has to be less than the next best option. To be clear, forcing does not reduce of energy efficiency does not reduce emissions. It reduces the cost of overall compliance. Energy efficiency can be excluded due to these policy elements that I talked about, the free allowances to regulated entities, or due to market barriers. So let me talk about I've talked about price, hopefully not too quickly, or at least you heard enough that we can go talk about it in the hall or something, or review, or Karen can pick up the pieces here. But let me hit on the non-price barriers. I laid out my top five. I'm going to throw out, there's some others mixed in here. But on the left side, with that negative cost, right, there are, in the McKinsey cost curve, I just kind of put them up against there. There are a lot of reasons why the curve could look like that. And it could be because of those split incentives that I mentioned earlier. It could be because of bounded rationality. It could be because of their lack of information and people aren't making the decisions that they should because they lack that information. It could also be because people are making choices, and this is revealing their preferences. So people are choosing, rather than to invest in energy efficiency, they're choosing to put their kids through college or to buy a big screen television. And some people will argue that no one is going to – that basically everything that you do is a negative cost, or at least you perceive it that way. So if I go buy a big screen television, I expect to get more benefits out of it over time than I pay for it. And so – the point here is that there's many non-price barriers you really got to look at individually, I think, to understand where they're coming from, and not assume that just because consumers aren't doing what you want them to do, that's a market barrier. That's the risk when we get into the market barriers discussions. Is it's easy to say, oh well, they didn't do what I thought, and so therefore, we got a problem here. On the right side, I've thrown in energy subsidies and externality costs, and I just want to underscore this, that one of the risks with a carbon price that I see is that many people see is that you're going to get a big nuclear power build. I don't have a problem with nuclear power generically. I do have a problem if we're not taking into account the negative externalities associated with nuclear power. So we've accounted for the negative externalities of carbon associated with oil, gas, and coal, but we're not accounting for negative externalities associated with nuclear. And so I think that's probably one of the biggest risks that we face in terms of, with a cap and trade, of not addressing these other market barriers that exist. And I think I've, in the interest of time, So not all barriers can be conquered. I don't want to suggest that they can. I do suggest that we try. I still think even if we don't address those market barriers, we're closer, we're better off than with a carbon cap and trade or a carbon price than if we don't have one. I just remind you, if they are ignored, that the risk is that the cost of overall abatement will be higher. Different approaches are different. The different barriers require different policy approaches. McKinsey is actually considering is trying to put together sponsorship for another study to go look at exactly what's causing that negative cost structure and what can you do about it. I think ACEEE is signed up on that, and Edison Electric Institute and others. So if anybody else is interested in wrestling with this issue, they'd probably welcome. I know my boss would not appreciate me coming out and plugging other people's studies, but I think it's an important exercise, and they've got a good start on it. The energy policies in brief, let me just give you the lay of the land of our portfolio of policies and how they fit in with these market barriers. And this is not precise, we need to make it more precise. But the carbon price, I just want to underscore that one of the things that few other policies that we talk about or that are on the table to do are policy can address. It addresses services demand. So you can go do CAFE, corporate average fuel economy standards for vehicles. You can go do appliance standards. You can go do building codes for homes. But if people's homes just get bigger, they're more efficient, but just get bigger. If the appliances, now the energy cost is less, and so they go buy a bigger air conditioner where the smaller one was the one that was the appropriate size, or do weird things like that, then these other policies generally do not get at that issue. And that's one reason why I think prices is so important, service demand. But the vehicle equipment, appliance standards, building codes, they'll address the lack of information. That's kind of surprising to some people. But if you think about it, basically, the regulation is communicating what's the right thing, and you can argue about whether it's the right thing. But the consumer no longer needs to have any information; they're being told what to do. I don't know about you, but I often prefer just to be told what to do. I got too many decisions in life, and I don't personally have a problem with it. The standards and codes also deal with the split incentive issue. In fact, it's one of probably the best and maybe the perhaps the no, it's not the only, but it's probably the best ways to deal with split incentives. So make my landlord only be able to go buy that Energy Star appliance, and so then we don't have to worry about it. Labeling addresses lack of information and split incentives. This is a huge information issue. Cars are relatively well labeled. We have in the U.S. The Energy Guide label for some home appliances, and we have Energy Star, which is an endorsement label, which says, you know, what's good, what should you buy. But we don't have labeling for buildings, and that's probably a big hole, and it's a big challenge too. I'm not saying this is an easy task, but a lot of people are really getting focused on this right now, internationally as well as in the U.S., to try to figure out how to let people know when they walk in, when they go to rent or go to buy a building, what their energy is like. I am very close, Sarah. Okay. Tax incentives can address a lack of information as well. If you have a carbon price, I say tax incentives are probably less valuable because they're largely an economic instrument trying to reduce the relative cost of energy efficiency relative to energy. But they do have some value in terms of communicating that government really likes this stuff or utilities really like this stuff. Energy efficiency resource standards, the real advantage, utilities can do anything. Energy efficiency resource standard just says that electric utilities got to go out and do energy efficiency, and they got to do a specified amount. The utilities, that doesn't say how to do it. The utilities can go do it a lot of different ways. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell them how to do it because, frankly, I'm not sure. They may be best suited to go out and address the local barriers that their own ratepayers face in terms of their energy use. Let me just throw also labor force education and training. To respond to these policies, if you're going to have a big build on energy efficiency, you're going to need people to do it. And energy efficiency, sometimes it's stuff I can do, right? I'm basically day labor level. But there's a lot of specialized skills involved. Going in and recommissioning this building, for instance, walking through and figuring out how to optimize this building system is not an easy task. And I'd say probably there are about 10 people in the country who can really go do it on a wholesale level and provide guidance on recommissioning. There's other people that work for them, but those are the maestros of this R&D, and we'll need more R&D investment, because we're still, as I pointed out earlier, still going to need game changers, both with efficiency and everything else. Let me recap, and then I'll make a final note. So I just want to recap. I want to make very clear that I think that there's a lot of efficiency potential, but also very clear that we decide how much potential is out there. That it's not, I don't believe that there's such thing really as a passive energy efficiency potential estimate. It's too dependent on what you're willing to do on the policy front. Energy efficiency is often the cheapest, cleanest, and easiest resource out there, but energy efficiency is not free. The ability to get people to implement it is still to be determined on the kind of scale that we need to achieve. And some of us in the community are more optimistic than others, but it's the only way that I know of to find out how much we can really get, how much scale we can get on energy efficiency, is to go do it and learn by doing. And we can be smart about that. There are a lot of ways to do it dumb, and we need to be careful, but if we're smart, I don't think we lose. Let me just give my final plea. I said prospects for cap and trade, but actually this is a plea for cap and trade. It's my final slide, Sarah. The economy's in recession. I know that. Budget, you know, people's their pocketbooks are tight. Some people don't have jobs. Some people are concerned about not having jobs. But I would note that, and so there's a lot of people who would say that the prospects for a carbon cap and trade are pretty dim right now. I would just note, though, that oil prices are down too, and that was what the excuse was going to be 3 or 4 months ago, was that oil prices are too high. Now they're down around 70. I haven't looked today, but 69. Okay, so $70. And let me point out with those two, my experience with energy efficiency anyway, and I think this is the case with carbon. Addressing the carbon issue generally, is that when the economy is good, people are too busy, and when the economy is bad, people can't afford it. And so there will never be a right time to do this. And if we wait for that right time, it'll never happen. The political stars are aligned like the experts at our office tell me they think they're aligned. Lieberman Warner made it to the floor last summer. That's the first time that a carbon cap and trade, or major climate legislation, in fact, has actually made it to the floor. Boucher and Dingell in the House have just 2 weeks ago released a new bill from the House side, which is pretty aggressive, very wide scope, aggressive targets. Reasonable cost containment measures. You know, I can go across the list, but in general, we think it looks pretty good, and I think the environmental community does as well. McCain and Obama are both strongly on the record with respect to this as well. There's opportunity on the political side. The biggest economic challenge is uncertainty. One of the things that, you know, if you look at why we're in the mess we're in economically, it's because we didn't deal with problems earlier. We keep putting it off and keep not addressing stuff. And I think we risk the same kind of problem with climate. If we just keep putting it off, we're going to be facing, you know, the president's going to be coming asking for $1 trillion in a year rather than tens of billions of dollars over 40 years. And nobody benefits from a standoff. Right now, I'm hearing the electric industry increasingly calling for a carbon price. We'll see where their carbon price is relative to mine. I know the oil industry is pretty widely, if not universally, on record as supporting a carbon price. And the reason is because they're having trouble making investment decisions with the uncertainty about whether there's going to be a carbon price and how much that carbon price is going to be. On the environmental side, and so basically the electric industry can't build power plants, for example, right now, or there's a lot of power plants that are kind of, you know, in limbo. Here's the risk. from the electric utility industry, they can hold off and fight and say we're not going to do this or whatever, and then another hurricane comes through that is, whether actual or not, is perceived as being climate related, and everybody's like, "But we're doing it," you know, and you got to and you know, it's going to happen. The risk on the environmental side is that we don't build power plants, we don't do anything on climate because we're in a stalemate, and 3 or 4 years from now, we start seeing brownouts or other types of issues that are ugly to people. And then they say, I don't care what you build. And you end up with a lot of more pulverized coal in place rather than coal plants with carbon capture and sequestration capability. And you end up with a lot of nuclear where you haven't addressed some of these very sticky issues related to nuclear waste and proliferation. And I don't want to pick on nuclear and those things. But So I say, let's not get distracted. Let's persevere and pursue a carbon price. That's my final word.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Yes, Joe is exactly right. One of the reasons why we chose him to come and be a speaker today was because in the National Petroleum Council study, we learned that Joe is such an honest broker with ideas that he can sustain an argument with himself across the table for a long period of time without very much addition from other people. So thanks, Joe, for that.
I think that's a compliment.
It is, absolutely, absolutely. We're going to go with Karen Palmer next, who's going to talk a little bit about, I'll let her tell you what she's going to talk about.
Okay, thank you, Sarah, and thanks for the invitation to speak today. Joe had some very stimulating comments, so I may edit a little bit what I'm going to say. But let me start by giving you an outline of sort of the four major points I hope to cover in the next 10 minutes. One is to talk about some work that we've done on the past, looking back at effectiveness of prior energy efficiency policies, particularly those focused on energy use in buildings. And the next three points are related to the whole intersection between energy efficiency and cap and trade. And I'm going to talk about a question that came up a little bit in Joe's remarks in more depth, this question about how CO2 permits are allocated and how that's going to affect incentives that consumers have to conserve energy, particularly electricity. I'm also going to talk about another point he raised, which is this complementarity between efficiency policies and CO2 caps. And then the relationship between the second and third bullet, which is a particular allocation scheme and how that can be used to fund energy efficiency, where you're selling tons and buying megawatt hours. But I'm going to start with slide conserving move here, which is my blank slide. and hopefully to move it along a little bit and stick to my 10 minutes a little bit better. So let me talk a little bit about this effectiveness work that we've done in the past. You know, as Joe mentioned, a lot of studies have been recently done to try and assess the potential for energy efficiency. In addition to the McKenzie study, a lot of Skip's colleagues at ACEEE and other places have done state-specific studies because a lot of states want to know if we pursue energy efficiency, what are we likely to get for it. In the study that we did a couple years ago that was funded by the National Commission on Energy Policy, we took a different perspective, which is sort of looking at, well, what have we gotten from our energy efficiency programs so far? And this study focused, as I said, on energy efficiency programs or different types of programs that target buildings. And there are basically four types that we looked at, which are appliance standards, utility DSM programs, other types of information and voluntary programs, and the management of government energy use. And the study is fairly extensive and goes into a lot of detail about what these various types of programs are. But to kind of sum it up, what we found in looking at the literature and the data that folks have reported is that on an annual basis, these programs and buildings save probably up to 4 quads of energy annually. And in the early part of this decade, is equal to about 12% of residential and commercial energy consumption, not including the transport sector. Roughly half of those savings that we found were attributable to appliance standards and utility DSM programs. I think it's important to point out here that in the case of both of those programs, they're sort of, well, utility DSM in particular, they're reported savings that the utilities report to the Energy Information Administration. We're actually doing some work now. We're trying to see if we could recapture or how much of those savings are showing up in a statistical study of energy demand. So that's the information that we have, and that's the information that we looked at. But those appliance standards and energy efficiency programs accounted for about half of that, those savings that we were able to quantify. And those were the programs where the best information was available about costs. For the most part, both of those programs are cost-effective, although it's kind of hard to say on demand-side management programs because there isn't good data on the customer side of the costs in a collective sense. Program by program areas, there may be, but collectively it's hard to get. We did find that the CO2 emissions from, the CO2 savings from those programs are roughly 4% of total annual emissions, or 10% of the emissions that occur in residential and commercial buildings. Now, moving on to the climate policy topic, as Joe pointed out, if we have a climate policy that puts a price on carbon, presumably raising energy prices is going to lead to people to conserve energy. Focusing on the electricity sector for a moment, though, it really makes a difference how allowances are allocated. And the presumption is currently that the way a climate policy is going to work, it's probably going to be a cap-and-trade policy and not a CO2 tax of some sort. So if you have a cap-and-trade policy, I mean, in the past, the way they have always worked, like the SO2 program, is that the allowances, which represented some reduction from current or certainly in the future emissions that would be expected, were allocated to the emitters for free. But if you do that approach, well, if you think about the electricity sector and think about those parts of the country where electricity prices are determined in the marketplace instead of by regulation, then it really doesn't matter if you give the allowances away for free or if you sell them to the generators, which is an option that's being considered, and I'll say a bit more about in a moment. Either way, the opportunity cost of those allowances are going to be reflected in the prices that generators pay. So there will be some, that consumers pay. So there will be some incentive associated with the cap and trade that's passed on. However, if you're in a regulated part of the country, generators get their allowances for free, then you know, that free allowance gets passed on to consumers as a free allowance, and they don't really face the opportunity cost associated with using up those allowances to generate electricity. So already in a country that has some places where wholesale prices of electricity are determined at market and other places where they're not, you're going to get this schism in how consumers are affected if allowances are given away for free. One way that's been proposed to deal with that disparity is not give allowances to generators who may be operating in competitive markets, but give allowances to local utilities who face a regulated rate for distributing the electricity to your house. So at least the cost of that distribution is typically regulated. If you give the allowances to those folks, then the benefits that they get from ultimately selling them back to the generators who need them for compliance will be passed on to customers, and everybody, it will mute the price impact of having a cap and trade. But the problem with that is, while it would be popular with electricity ratepayers, it won't provide adequate incentives to save electricity. So another way to get rid of this difference between regulated and competitive regions would be to auction the allowances off for everybody. And that way, everybody sort of pays the opportunity cost, and you get an equal treatment across all the different regions, at least in the approach. Of course, in regions where there's more emitting generators, that there be a typically a higher impact on price. But work that we've done actually shows that those regions tend to have lower prices in general, and they would have lower prices typically after the auction takes place than the average under a particular cap-and-trade program. So the effects that this program, that capping allowances, capping emissions would have on incentives for consumers to save that are embodied in the price are going to depend upon the design of the program. Joe mentioned that one of the features that we try to have, or that policymakers are trying to put into cap-and-trade programs to limit the uncertainty, is some sort of safety valve on the price or provisions to buy offsets. Well, another thing that could help limit the cost of the program is to actually couple it with some sort of energy efficiency programs, and that's certainly the approach that they've been taking in California, where there's a cap envisioned not just for the building sectors but also for transport, but there's also policies to promote efficiency that are going along with that. But one way that you could coupled these programs is to actually use an auction to distribute the allowances and then use the revenues from that auction to promote efficiency. And this is at least part of the approach that's being taken in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, where we do actually have a cap on emissions of CO2 from electricity generators taking effect starting in 2009. And for the most part, those allowances are being auctioned off, and the revenues, at least some portion, and in some states a substantial portion of those revenues, are being used to fund energy efficiency. That's also a proposal that exists in several of the federal bills, as well as in the third phase of the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme, is to use some of the revenues to fund energy efficiency. Today, the Center for Integrative Environmental Research is releasing a study that they're at University of Maryland that was done for the Maryland Department of Environment that involved ourselves, folks from University of Maryland, some researchers at Johns Hopkins, and some at Towson University, looking at the effect of varying how much of that allowance revenue you spend on energy efficiency on the implementation of REGI in Maryland. And I'm just going to present a couple of slides quickly from that study to show what the effects are of using increasingly larger share of allowance revenue to fund efficiency. So bringing some light back to the screen, what we looked at was three different cases, one where 25% of this revenue is used to fund efficiency, and then 50% and 100%. And what this graph shows is the amount of efficiency expenditures that you're getting. In our analysis, the price of REGI allowances, which we'll see in a moment, is determined within the analysis itself. And I think that, so that's very dependent upon what the price of the allowances would be that you would realize is the height of these efficiency expenditure bars. But then on the right-hand side, you see, well, what are the demand reductions that you're getting? The caveat here is this depends importantly on what you're assuming about the costs of supplying energy efficiency, and we can get more into that, how we went about making those assumptions in the question and answer period. So this shows sort of what the demand reductions were that resulted from that. To put this in perspective, we also anticipated that there might be some effect of more spending on efficiency in Maryland on the price of electricity in Maryland. Really, there wasn't a lot of effect there in just looking at the Maryland case, but there's a big effect on electricity expenditure. And what this shows here is at the top, the different colored bars, which we'll make a little bit bigger here, show how much electricity is being saved as you increase the efficiency expenditures. And you'll notice that the size of those sort of slices out of the bars are kind of going up a little bit over time, and that's because the stringency of the program goes up over time, so the price and the value of those allowances that you're auctioning off goes up over time. This also has implications for the price of REGI allowances. What this graph shows is under different assumptions about efficiency spending, 25%, which is sort of the minimum that you would expect under this program, versus 100%, you see that the more money you spend on efficiency, the lower the cost of complying with this program in terms of the price of a REGI allowance. And the reason for that is that lower demand for energy means lower demand for allowances, so there's a little bit more slack in the market. This particular study that's coming out today focuses on Maryland specifically, but we also did this analysis at RFF for the broader REGI program, and you actually see bigger effects. So here we see that what if all the 10 states involved in REGI varied from spending 25% of their allowance revenue on efficiency to, which is the minimum shown in the red line, down to 100%, which is the maximum in the green line. And you see that that would have a very substantial effect on the forecasted price of REGI allowances. And it also has an important effect on the electricity price. So as Joe pointed out, you know, one way to lower sort of the cost impacts of achieving a particular cap, in all these scenarios, we're achieving the REGI cap on emissions of CO2. So there aren't really any CO2 benefits, but there are benefits in terms of lowering the cost, making it more palatable, and perhaps ultimately creating some political will to create a more stringent policy. It's particularly in the REGI case, the policy isn't particularly stringent. So let me just leave you now with some information about, if you wanted to learn more, the study that has the retrospective examinations was published in the Annual Review of Environment and Resources. Actually, we have another study that I didn't list up here about allowance allocation that's also available on our website. And the Maryland study is going to be posted today at the CIER website. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Karen. Next up is Larry Makovich from Cambridge Energy Research Associates, who's going to talk a little bit about the cost of energy efficiency addresses, some work he's done on the negative cost issues.
Thanks very much. And it's very nice to be with you all here today talking about this very important issue. And I think the reason, you know, we're all here today is we agree that climate change is a huge challenge, maybe the biggest challenge that we've ever faced as a country or a global community, and we've got to do something. And I think it's pretty clear that increasing efficiency is going to be an important way to tackle the climate challenge. And increasing efficiency is going to be an important part of any plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, my focus has been on, well, how much and what is it going to cost? And I've been focusing on the power business and trying to ascertain what is it going to cost to increase electric efficiency in the U.S. power sector. And to answer that question, you have to start first by saying, well, increasing from what? And I think, you know, Joe pointed out that efficiency happens. You know, when we go out and make decisions about what air conditioner are we going to buy, what dishwasher are we going to buy, what home are we going to buy, what kind of windows are we going to have in that home, we make decisions, we make trade-offs, and there's a level of efficiency that gets established in the economy. And the good news is we've been getting more efficient through time. Now, the typical family has an income a little bit less than $50,000 in the U.S. today, and they've got to make some trade-offs. They can buy more energy-efficient windows. They can re-insulate their homes. They can replace their lighting systems with more efficient systems. They can replace their heating systems, their air conditioners, their washers, their ovens, their microwaves. But, of course, there's other things we have to worry about as families, kids' college educations, maybe a vacation, the soccer league fees and so forth, and people make trade-offs. You can't do everything that promises a positive return. And so those decisions that are made by consumers and households and producers and companies establish a level of efficiency. So I think we have to realize that efficiency produces benefits greater than costs. But even with some market barriers and imperfections, if a market is working pretty well, we don't expect people to make every efficiency investment that's available with a positive return. We see them make some, but we don't expect them to make all. Now, if you don't understand that basic point, that you can't do everything because our incomes are limited, you'll get some very distorted expectations about efficiency in the future. Now, the McKinsey study has come up here. One of these quotes is out of the McKinsey study from last December. One quote is out of Business Week in 1984 from Amory Lovins. All right? It's hard to figure out which is which. All right? But the idea here is efficiency is so cost-effective that if we just do everything that's cost-effective, we never really have to build another power plant in this country. All right? The bottom one here happens to be the one that's 25 years old. Amory Lovins in Business Week 25 years ago telling the world the economics of efficiency is so great that we're going to actually have to close down power plants. Since that prediction was made, the power industry is about twice as big as it was 25 years ago. All right. So getting expectations right is pretty important, which brings us to this curve. It was interesting that Joe said, has anybody not seen this curve? Because it's very influential. All right. But let's look at what does it actually say? Start on the left. Let's do the things that are most cost effective. All right. If you don't do anything, your total cost to increase efficiency is zero. So let's do the first thing. Our total cost is a negative number. Let's do the next one. Our total cost is a negative number that's bigger. Let's do the next efficiency option. It's a bigger and bigger negative number until we get over to nuclear, which has a zero cost. Now, most people know it doesn't cost zero to build a nuclear plant. The curve is saying, well, it'll cost the same as building a coal plant that people are going to do, so let's build the nuclear plant instead. Oh, okay, we got to give something up to do something else. Now go over to the positive side, and do things that have a positive cost. What this curve literally says is when the area on the positive side is equal to the area on the negative side, your total cost goes to zero. What this curve literally says is out at about 17 gigatons, the total cost of CO2 abatement up to 17 gigatons is zero. It's free. All right. Worldwide CO2 emissions are 26 gigatons. So that the study that came out in December with the U.S. curve that Joe showed you suggests that the U.S. economy can double in size between now and 2030. We can reduce our CO2 emissions to below 2007 levels for free. Now, when something sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't true. All right? There's a logical flaw in putting this together, and the flaw is the negative cost idea. All right? Because if you're going to have consumers do some of the options that they chose not to do, because they chose to do some but not all, all of those efficiency things there are the efficiency investments people didn't make in the reference case. If you're going to have them make them, they've got to give up the vacation that they did instead, something that they decided was more valuable to them. So to do all the efficiency things that have positive cost, benefits above costs that people decide not to do in a base case comes at a positive, not a negative cost. All right, so then what is the cost of increasing efficiency? And I've got a working definition of efficiency. All right, it's let's use less electricity and not make ourselves worse off. Like if you just want to use less electricity per capita, you can look around the world for best practices, and that would be Haiti. Right? Haiti uses very little electricity per person because they happen to have a fraction of the income per capita that we do. So if the working idea here is let's use less electricity without making ourselves worse off. That's an efficiency gain. All right, then if you look at consumer behavior, and there are barriers out there, but basically it looks like it's pretty clear statistically. In states where the price of electricity is higher, people use less electricity. Right? They invest in more efficiency. That's pretty clear. So actually, if you look at the demand curve for electricity in the U.S., it actually tells you how much do people value electricity. All right. And so let's use 2007 as a reference point. And what it says is people value electricity in the U.S. at about $18.9 trillion. All right. Now, consumers paid $343 billion for the power that they consumed. So they value it about 60 times greater than what they have to pay for it. All right, is that just economic mumbo jumbo, you know, consumer surplus? All right, think about a blackout. Even if it's a rolling blackout where you give people some notice, all right? What happens in a blackout is the meter stops spinning. You're saving people money. But they get mad because they value their electricity a whole lot more than what they have to pay for it. All right? And so, in fact, when people say they want 99.99% reliability on power, it kind of indicates that they value their electricity a lot more than they have to pay for it. What's the total variable cost of production, the area under that supply curve there? It's about $193 billion. So there's a producer surplus there of about $150 billion that covers fixed costs and some profit. So look, consumers and producers in the economy value the electricity we produced in 2007, and we can measure that. All right, so if we put a price on carbon, increase the price of electricity, we will reduce the amount of electricity people use. All right, so if we put a $30 per ton charge on CO2, that's going to shift that supply curve up. It's going to increase power prices by about 13%. People will use about 5% less electricity. There'll be about 6% less CO2 produced out of the power sector. And the value that is lost from consumers and producers from having increased the price of electricity with a carbon charge, even if you can take that carbon charge and take all that money and circulate it back at no cost to consumers, there is a cost that you impose on consumers by doing that, and that's about $2.3 billion. So what we can do is we can say, all right, we can put a price on carbon, we can increase the price of electricity, people will use less, let's keep them whole for having done that, let's not make them worse off, and express that as a cost per ton of carbon reduced. And here's what the curve looks like. This is all preliminary research at CERA. We haven't written it up and released it yet, but what it shows you is if you want to increase electric efficiency to reduce CO2, you can do it. It comes at a positive, not a negative cost, and it's a positive cost that goes up the more you want to do. So I think the conclusion here is pretty critical. What it shows you is, yes, efficiency is a real resource. Jim Rogers' fifth fuel. It's like any other economic commodity. If you want some of it, it's going to come at a cost. You want more of it, the cost will go up. It's really important to get a good fix on these costs because, one, as Joe mentioned, you want to get a good balance between the cost of CO2 reduction and the benefit of internalizing this externality. So you want to get a good fix on cost to set targets and timetables right. Two, you want to get a good fix to balance the cleanup approach, right? You want to do efficiency. You want to do some supply-side options. You want to balance those marginal costs because this is going to be expensive, and you want to minimize the cost of getting to any target. Three, you want to distribute this cost burden fairly. If it's going to be expensive, even if it's very worthwhile to do, if we put these costs on electric power, it's going to be very regressive. Households with lower incomes spend a bigger percentage of their expenditures on energy, and if we just pile this all on power prices, it's going to be a very unfair burden to lower-income families. And finally, the other big challenge here is we're talking about a lot of money. If we put a $30 a ton charge on the power sector, we're talking about $67 billion a year that we're going to be collecting. I've assumed that we can recirculate those revenues without a cost back to people, and that's why we still have to come up with the additional 2.3. But if we're not efficient and cost-effective in that recirculation, that's going to add cost too. So it has its place, but there's no free lunch here. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much, Larry. Next, we've got Skip Leitner from ACEEE. He's going to talk about the size of the efficiency market and some commercial opportunities. You want yours? Leitner, okay.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning. Let me begin my comments with a remark by John Wheeler, who physicist emeritus at Princeton University some years ago, maybe 20 years ago. Wheeler was the man who invented or coined the phrase black hole, and he commented to some reporters asking him how the heck they're coming up with some of the discoveries they are in the world of quantum mechanics and now nanoparticles and the like. And his comment was, we shape the world by the questions we ask. And by implication, if we're not asking the right questions, we may not be getting very satisfactory answers. And in that spirit, I'm going to disagree with Larry. He's asking the wrong question. It's not a question of negative cost, but it's can we find productive investments in the economy at all levels to more effectively use efficiency in a way that generates a return? If I put $1 million down for various sorts of efficiencies and I'm saving $200,000 a year, that's a 20% return on my investment. It's not a negative cost per se. I had to make the investment, but a 20% return on that investment is probably better than I'm going to find elsewhere in the economy. So the opportunity cost would seem to favor a good bit of the efficiency resource. And I think this is going to be a critical issue that we're going to need to discuss. And Sarah, maybe that's going to be the nub of some future discussions, how we view these efficiency resources in terms of negative costs or a productive investment with a significant return on it. But that said, I'm going to talk about how big efficiency, and drawing from a talk that I first came across about 12 years ago, Richard Feynman, who was a Caltech physicist and Nobel laureate. In 1959, this is even before we had learned to manipulate cesium atoms to spell the word IBM under a microscope, he was talking about the ability to store the entire Encyclopedia Britannica on the head of a pin. In other words, he was digging down so that we had a better understanding of the physics and the chemistry of the physical world in ways that we're only now beginning to appreciate. And he said in 1959, if we haven't begun to really tackle this, it's because we've not made the decision to do so. And it's the same context with the efficiency resource. There are more ways of exploring that opportunity if we choose to do so, and that's precisely my comments here today. Efficiency is bigger than we might imagine, but only if we choose to develop it, and that's the question before us. So let me offer this thought experiment. What is the color of the element gold? A thought experiment. It's a child's game, yes, and it's a trick question. Yes, at the mesoscale, gold is indeed the color of gold. But at the nanoscale, it can be orange, it can be red, it can be green, many other colors, as the color is affected by the swirling particles that interact around it, and hence things aren't always as they initially appear, and some things require a closer inspection. And with that in mind, I think there is a need to do our homework as we try to frame the efficiency potential, check our biases going into any policy analysis, and occasionally change the rules of the game. Now, I had an attempt to try and change the rules of the game. I was going to introduce three of my colleagues to introduce different aspects of the efficiency potential very quickly. And I'm going to still be able to do this, I think, with Dick Munson, who is the Senior Vice President, Recycled Energy Development on Capturing Waste Energy. Is his slides up here? Dick? 2 minutes.
I appreciate the center's willingness to deal with this odd approach. My comment is simply, as you think about efficiency, I encourage you to think about what inefficiency is. And inefficiency is basically waste. And waste in this society is unbelievably pervasive. I think it's ironic that the policy community doesn't seem to get it, but you ask virtually any school kid to draw a picture of a power plant, and you'll see something like Homer Simpson's. What dominates this picture? The vast plumes of waste energy that are just being vented out into the atmosphere. That is energy that can be captured. It is currently wasted. The picture, the cartoon picture, unfortunately, matches the reality of the supply side efficiency out in society. This is the electric generating facility at Craig, Colorado, where two-thirds of the energy within the burn fuel is wasted, producing an efficiency rate of 33%, something that has not changed since Dwight Eisenhower was in the White House. And I could show numerous other pictures of waste at industrial plants across the country. Can we capture waste energy? You bet. In the interest of time, I won't do that one. But this is a furnace at a silicon plant in Alloy, West Virginia. We're going to recycle the waste heat coming off that furnace, turn it into 45 megawatts of clean electricity. We're going to reduce CO2 emissions by 290,000 metric tons annually. The silicon manufacturer is going to use the cost savings and extra power to open up the sixth furnace, employ 30 additional industrial jobs. So when you hear somebody suggest that tackling climate change or efficiency will hurt the economy, I suggest you consider what's happening in Alloy in capturing waste heat. West Virginia Alloy is creating jobs. They're bringing silicon manufacturing back from China to the United States because they're more productive. Similar energy efficiency opportunities exist, according to DOE and EPA studies, about 200,000 megawatts. What stands in the way? There's lots of things. Certainly getting the price right is one key one, but I would suggest there's a variety of outmoded laws and regulations. My firm, for instance, we can build a gas pipeline, steam pipes, basically anything under a public street. We try and run an electric wire over or under a public street, we're going to jail. Our facilities reduce line losses. We decrease redundancy requirements. We get absolutely no value from those benefits that we provide. We face cumbersome interconnection standards that restrict us from connecting to the grid. So I would suggest the list of regulatory barriers are long. If tackled, efficiency will flourish. Is that 2 minutes?
A little bit over, but that's great. Thank you. And at this point, let me now introduce my colleague, Paula Collins, who is Vice President of Governmental Relations at Texas Instruments, who will say a few remarks on innovation within the semiconductor industry. You can come up here, sure. We got 3 minutes left.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that the semiconductor industry has been looking at the challenge of energy efficiency and has actively been developing various products to help harness existing resources more effectively and to use energy more efficiently. And we kind of put this into three buckets of issues that we look at. One is in sort of the make-it mode. semiconductor technology and other electronics are making renewable sources of energy cheaper and more accessible, whether it's for capturing and converting solar energy and maximizing the efficiency of wind energy, hydro energy, thermal energy, and making solar and wind effective even on cloudy days and on no wind, low wind days. But it's also helpful in using getting conventional sources of energy much more efficiently than it has been in the past. We also are very focused on the distribution of energy. We call it make it, move it, use it. And this is the move it realm, which smart meters, intelligent grids, self-correcting mechanisms, time-of-use billing, all these things are enabled by technology and can provide enormous savings. There are examples that show that people who just actually move their meters inside to their house will save 15% of their electricity once they see how fast that meter's going around. And then on the use it side, numerous opportunities, and it's not just in electronics, it's in industrial machinery. If you think that two-thirds of the world's industrial electricity runs on electric motors, but only 5% of them use variable speed drives, great opportunity to save energy. Motion and video sensors are increasingly being used to identify whether people are in buildings for light, for ventilation, for air conditioning. Again, all these things that will reduce electricity seamlessly. And in transportation sector, electronics have been increasingly a focus in terms of helping to reduce energy use. And if you think about the internal combustion engine, hasn't really changed much since 1884, but the electronics in the cars have really made them much more fuel efficient. They're continuing to play roles in the hybrid vehicles and the plug-in vehicles as well. And the list goes on in terms of lighting, LED lighting, appliances. Again, motors and appliances can very seamlessly have an impact, and we just need to begin to harness some of those activities. So,
thank you, Paula. And finally, very quickly, my colleague, Dr. Karen Erhard-Martinez, on the behavioral resource of efficiency.
Thanks. Yeah, I just want to take two quick minutes, to talk about good behavior and bad behavior, or, in other words, talking about behavior as an important way of accessing efficiency. That it's not just about getting the prices right. And what do I mean by that? I mean two things. One, we need to think about how behaviors, norms, values, preferences, all of these things can shape patterns of energy consumption and how big those energy savings can be. So, in essence, there are many ways that we can tap into behavior-based energy savings, and we're really only beginning to really understand and utilize many of them. For example, there's some new research in California that shows that, in fact, people dramatically reduce their energy consumption as a result of simply learning the truth behind energy consumption norms. When people know how much consumption, energy consumption levels might vary from one household to the next, and believe me, it's huge, it really does shape the individual household's energy consumption patterns in interesting ways. For example, there are several research studies by psychologist Robert Cialdini indicating that social norms have successfully changed household energy consumption patterns and consumption levels by 10% or more. And now there's a group in California that's using social norms research to help utilities help their customers reduce electricity consumption and also to reduce their energy bills. So this is just one example of how social and behavioral sciences can unlock behavioral mechanisms for energy efficiency. And a lot of these don't require incurring any cost. So research by Gardner and Stern that was just published this month, in fact, and is consistent with ACEEE's own research, indicates that behavior-based energy savings potential is on the order of 25% of current levels of consumption. So fortunately, the level of interest in this is in the behavioral mechanisms is beginning to grow, and one indication of the explosion of interest in this area is the registration for a newly created conference that we're actually holding our second conference this year on behavior, energy, and climate change. And it's very much focused on the behavioral elements to saving energy and to reducing energy consumption and achieving energy efficiency. And that conference will be held in November of this year, the 16th through the 19th, and it's about 700 registrants. So just like I said, an indication of the level of interest. So I think the important point here is that there are behavioral mechanisms that offer a huge untapped potential in terms of energy savings, and that those types of savings aren't even accounted for in that McKinsey curve that you looked at earlier.
Thank you. And we'll jump to the end of the presentation here. My last slide I want to show is how much in the way of efficiency investments. Preliminary estimates from our studies indicate that cost-effective efficiency might be on the order of 45 to 50 billion barrels of oil equivalent between now and the year 2030, compared to offshore drilling of about 18 billion barrels equivalent, about 2.5 times that offshore resource. This would be sufficient to drive down energy use 2030 to mid-1990 levels with an economy that's still 70% larger today. But the question, and I think all of us would agree, will we choose to develop that resource? And again, the need to do our homework, to check our biases, and occasionally to change the rules. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Skip and friends. I think that was really useful. We only have about 10 minutes left. We can probably go over. We've got the room for a little bit longer if you all are interested in asking some additional questions. I'm going to bypass my opening questions. We have two ground rules here, though. If we've got people in the back with microphones, please just state your name and affiliation, and if your question can actually be in the form of a question, that would be great. So if any questions from the audience for our panels, I'd also encourage our panelists, if you have questions or discussion for each other, maybe we'll let a couple of the audience members get their questions in since we have sort of a lack of time. But then if you have questions for each other, please feel free. Any questions?
Bill Hederman, Congressional Research Service. We saw in several presenters graphs that showed lower effectiveness, if you will, as you move along the supply curve. The federal high-performance building standards are going for zero in 2020. We saw what California's zero-emission vehicle did for vehicle efficiencies. As an engineer, I always think 80-20, and I'm wondering if having a 2020 zero target is a bad thing or a good thing. I'd be interested in your opinions.
I guess I'll respond first. It's a challenging thing, that's for sure. And I don't. In general, I would say that the supply curve for energy efficiency is upward sloping. The costs are going to go up the more you do, but I think it's hard to know because we're talking a lot of those policies that you're talking about are over decades, and there are a lot of things that can shift the supply curve for energy efficiency. But in very uncertain ways. And I just give two examples, you know, stand out in my mind. Photovoltaics is an example of where people have been saying it was going to be 7 cents or 6 cents a kilowatt hour for 30 years. And it's still probably 20, 25 cents a kilowatt hour. And that's not to say we shouldn't go still pursue it. I'm just saying that there maybe people were a little bit too optimistic about the costs there. On the other hand, there have been many, you know, the Clean Air Act standards and probably some of the car standards where the affected industries would have said that they were going to all be out of business, you know, as soon as you instituted those things, and they actually proved to be much less expensive than the industry certainly would have argued, and we've seen that repeatedly. And so I think the jury's out, and again, some of the policies out there are really stretch goals. It's because we got to think ambitiously and we got to think aggressively. Because of the charts I showed you up there, we ain't anywhere near, given the current, you know, the stuff that's on the shelf, we're not anywhere near where we need to get. And so if we're going to even approach it, we've got to go after everything, including even such, you know, things that almost sound a little bit wild as zero energy buildings. And I'm you know, certainly skeptical in the short run that we're going to achieve it, and I'm definitely skeptical that it's going to be free, but I think it's worth pursuing until we know better.
Yeah, just to add to what Joe has said, you know, when I talk about what we think the costs of CO2 abatement with current technology look like, and it looks like it's going to be expensive. Now, what that says then is if there's technological improvement, and I think that zero energy buildings, I'm not sure if you would classify that as current technology, near technology, or something that still has to be developed. I'd say it's probably at least on the fringe of technology, but I think technological change becomes a very clear focus for any kind of climate change policy that's going to work, because I don't think we can get to where we want to go with current technology. And so these kinds of programs that are designed to push the envelope and create some technological breakthroughs, I think are going to be absolutely necessary to get to any kind of carbon reduction target like the scientists are saying we need to get to on any kind of a cost basis that's going to be manageable.
Did you have a question?
Could I add something real quick?
Sure.
I'm sorry. I come back again to the carbon price and setting the ground rules for realizing these kind of achievements that we're talking about here, and that I'm very confident of the ability of people to innovate in America and elsewhere, but they'll innovate a hell of a lot more if they know what they're innovating for, and if we keep the price of carbon at zero, I don't expect them to do nearly as much innovating as if we do $30 per ton. That's where, in some cases, I just to set up controversy, some places where I wonder whether Larry and I disagree more than I think we do is that sometimes I wonder whether he's arguing for not setting up those ground rules by virtue of there being this uncertainty and we don't know the costs and all those sort of things. And that's my big fear, and I would hate to leave this room with us thinking, oh, there's uncertainty out there and therefore we shouldn't do anything. There's always going to be uncertainty, and that's what, in fact, government's here to deal with, usually, very uncertain things.
Yeah, just as a clarifying point, I'm certainly not arguing that we shouldn't do anything. In fact, I started off my presentation saying that it's very clear we have to do something, and I think we have to face up to the costs of what it's going to be, given current technology, and that doesn't mean, if something's expensive, it doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't do it, but I think we ought to be smart about what we do and recognize what we're up against on the costs here to get the targets, timetables, mix, and burden distributed fairly.
Mm-hmm. Judy. I'm Judy Blanchard with Chevron, and I wanted to emphasize again the regulatory barriers. I mean, there are a lot of companies right now that are trying to implement energy efficient, you know, measures of some sort. And I see that there's this connection between the cap and trade and getting energy efficiency measures in place. But you can have a cap and trade program, and then you would still have the regulatory barriers. For instance, for combined heat and power, you know, programs that we're trying to implement, and then you're going to be blocked. Some of those regulatory barriers are at the local level. Some of them are at the state level. So by having a cap and trade program at the federal level doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to implement all these different measures of any sort. And I was wondering if you could comment on that. And then I do have a quick second question, which is kind of the role of the federal government as the single largest consumer of energy and what role you can see them playing in energy efficiency as well.
Thank you. Karen, you want to take that?
Well, I just wanted to say that, as I mentioned, in California, through the implementation of AB 32, they have a fairly broad cap. It covers utilities and a lot of other point sources, and also is intended to cover the transportation sector. But they are recognizing that some of these barriers, like that the cap would go towards dealing with the fact that the externality associated with climate change isn't price. But to the extent that there are other types of barriers, like Joe was talking about, to energy efficiency and or regulatory barriers, like the questioner mentioned, they have other complementary policies that they're putting into place that should help hopefully alleviate some of those barriers. And they've actually had to quantify what the emissions reductions are associated with those. Of course, they aren't emission reductions beyond the cap. They're just another way of dealing with complementary market failures that might be out there.
Yeah, I've got a two-part response. I think the issue of barriers that Dick mentioned and you've also raised is a critical one. My colleague Gary Reisner, who Vice President of Weyerhaeuser, had a chart some years ago of over 200 different barriers in the form of regulatory compliance, permit issues, zoning issues, and the like. I found almost overwhelming and am hugely sympathetic to that problem. It's got to be a combination of, yes, a price signal so that we get the message, and then enabling an ability to respond to that price signal through things like better information, incentives, and also removal of barriers. I think one of the critical issues that we're facing is the inability to see the efficiency resource. And note my comment at the end was suggesting that we could get down to mid-1990 levels if we choose to develop that resource by the removal of barriers, by a better pricing mechanism, and by incentives and information. But that still means we've still got energy that's using carbon that has to be dealt with in other ways. So there has to be a balance. But the critical issue in my mind is the ability to see that resource, better understand what the complete array of barriers are across the whole spectrum, and then to step back and see what we choose to develop, because it will take a development to bring it online.
Larry and Joe.
Okay. Yeah, on the market barrier side, I think that for 30 years, there's this efficiency gap idea out there that there's extensive market barriers that are preventing efficiency from being what it ought to be. And I think that market barriers are always a question of degree. I don't think no one's arguing that there aren't market barriers to some degree in the efficiency side of things. But the question is, are they big enough that they can make CO2 reduction, having the CO2 release in the United States for free? Are they big enough to create that much inefficiency? And the more we've looked into the question of market barriers, they exist, but they don't look to be anywhere near big enough to make these kinds of negative cost free lunch kind of options available. And I think it's very ironic that the predominant policy approach that we're talking about here is a cap and trade. It's a market-based approach. I'm actually quite confident that a cap and trade approach that puts a price on the emissions of carbon will actually work well. It'll produce the kind of economic signal that fosters innovation and will get people to reduce their energy consumption. But it's ironic that a lot of these arguments for it are based upon a belief in massive market failure that's predominant throughout the energy sector. So just it's hard to reconcile the two.
I'll just quickly answer. One, on the regulatory barriers, I'm happy to work with you, and actually we work with Chevron and some other stuff to understand those barriers better and include them in our portfolio where they're consistent with our mission, of course. And I definitely – my presentation was not comprehensive, so there are things that I left off in terms of policies that we think about and in terms of the market barriers. On the role of the federal government consumes about 1% of U.S. energy use and emits about 1% of U.S. CO2 emissions. So it is a big single actor in the economy, certainly. They don't have carbon dioxide targets, and by virtue of there not being a carbon price, they don't really have any CO2 price that they're responding to. They do have aggressive energy intensity targets, and they've had them for a couple decades now and are generally meet them. I will just say that the feds are really like everybody else, from my experience, and I've done a lot of work with the federal government, and we actually have a report with recommendations, which I'd be happy to share with you. In fact, I'm probably one of three advocate experts on federal government energy management in Washington, not to toot my horn, but just to let you know that I'm aware of the issues. In general, it's the feds have a lot of mandates to purchase energy efficient equipment to become more efficient generally, but they don't have the money. And the reason they don't have the money is because Congress, it's easier for Congress to tell them to do stuff than to appropriate the funds to go do it. And the agencies, to some extent, have some choice in this. They submit their budgets every year to Congress, right, as part of the president's budget package, and they don't choose to put in money for energy efficiency because they have core mission priorities, and efficiency is not one of them. And so I say that because I think in many ways the federal government is a microcosm of, is just like other consumers. People are, as Larry says, people are out there making choices about how they're going to spend what are ultimately scarce resources.
Last question.
Stan Kaplan from CRS for Mr. Leitner. You were talking in your presentation about achieving 1990 or mid-1990 energy consumption by 2030 and still grow the economy. How much investment cost is required to achieve that?
Yeah, my colleague Karen Earhart Martinez and I published a report in, I think it was May of this year, Karen. We call it our How Big Efficiency Report, and we lay out some of those estimates. We're currently estimating that the investment in energy-efficient technologies, the base cost as well as the premium for the efficiency improvements, about $300 billion a year now. That could increase to about $700 billion a year by 2030, a slowly ramping up. And if at that rate, then, and I don't remember what that sums to, it's on the order of a couple trillions of dollars, which seems large, but the economy itself is going to have an investment over $60 trillion between now and the year 2030. So the question is, what kinds of policies can we put out there to redirect investment away from inefficient technology, inefficient investments, to more productive behaviors and technologies to achieve that? So it's really a substitution in a way that we haven't really begun to explore. So it's on that order. To give you another comparison, we estimate that annual investments in energy supply technologies are on the order of about $100 billion a year, power plants, transmission lines, oil wells, something like that. And the efficiency investments are substantially larger than that already. And the question, how can we build that resource through the removal of regulatory barriers and the like, but also, yes, through the appropriate pricing mechanism and then the information and giving consumers the wherewithal to respond to that price signal.
Well, great. I'd like to thank everyone for coming to this morning's event. Thank you for joining us, and I hope that you can help me thank our distinguished panel for taking their time and lending their expertise.